Okay.
I suppose we ought to mute people if they are muting, but I just want you to be answering questions well, pretty soon and straight away and all the way through, really. So some of you were here last week, which did sort of happen, but it wasn't the planned one. But at least we got going. And so this week we are doing what we might have done last week, and then next week what we might be doing this week, and then it sort of works like that. So if you were here last week, you know that today we are going to Samaria. We're going to visit the area of Samaria. Now, if you've got your own maps in your Bibles, you might want to look at that. I am going to put up one or two maps on the screen because in a moment, when we've had a chance to look at them, I want to just simply ask you, what do you notice? I don't know how familiar you are with Samaria, but when I looked at it, I found one or two interesting things that I hadn't thought of. So have a look if you've got your own map. Otherwise, there's something coming up here, hopefully, which will eventually, I've got more than one. Where are we now? This takes a while. I'm afraid if you put something in the chat, I'm not going to be able to see it. So whoever's put something in the chat, I won't be able to see that. I can't get the slideshow up at the moment. It's blocked.
That was me, Paul. I put in the chat. Now I understand why I tried every day to find last week's lecture and couldn't find it. So before I curse
Yeah.
Steve Maltz out for not putting it up, thanks
No,
for the explanation.
we didn't do that. I'm
Okay.
sorry, for some reason, I'm blocked from this because the bar has come up.
Steve, Paul, we have the map showing.
Yeah, but I haven't got it as a proper slideshow. I know you can see something,
Oh,
but
right.
oh, wait a minute. Hang on. I didn't realize I could actually move it. We're getting there. Here we go. But I don't quite know how to get that out of the way. Well, it's been updated. Anyway, as I was saying, here's some maps of Samaria. That's one of them. I'll put a couple more up just in case they give some other detail. That's actually probably the better one. So what I might do is actually come back to it in a minute, but let's see what else I've got. I've got that one. Well, that tells anything different. There's another one coming up. That's a very basic one by the looks of it, but sometimes basic is good. I think I'm going to go back to the first one. That might be one of the ones that is a bit more useful. You might have got something else, I don't know. Well, any comments on anything about Samaria that probably if you've just suddenly realized it and didn't know it before, I'm going to stop sharing for a minute, probably bring it up again later. Anyone got any thoughts? Just unmute and say something if you can.
I didn't recall that it went all the way west to the Mediterranean. I knew it was between Jerusalem and Galilee, but it's larger than I
Well,
thought.
that's exactly my first thoughts. Wow, isn't it big? And I didn't know it stretched the full width, which is very interesting. I just thought it was a bit of a blob sort of stuck in the middle there. But yeah, I suppose that's probably the main thing I was expecting you to come up with. I didn't realize how big it was and exactly how expansive it is from that point of view. Did anyone notice anything else there?
I was just going to say that you have to go through it or go round it every time you go from Jerusalem to Galilee. So Jesus did that journey every time he went to a festival,
Yeah,
going around the edge.
indeed. And that's leading very nicely into the first or the main study we're going to do, which is in John chapter 4. So if you want to find John chapter 4, I'll probably still just put the map up again because I might ask a more specific question in a minute about these. But if you find John chapter 4, on that map, there's one or two features which is going to be significant. Anyone want to comment on anything in that map or any of the features other than isn't it big?
Just to comment on about, you said somebody just said that to go from Galilee to Jerusalem, Jesus would have to pass through Samaria. But actually, the route most people think he used was to cross over the Jordan and walk down the other side of the Jordan and then come up through Jericho, which that way, not
Which
through,
is this
because
map
this
I've
is all
just.
mountains.
Yeah, it is very mountainous. This map shows it, a relief map. I mean, there was a
Yeah.
plain here, as there often is down here,
Yeah.
and it comes up and very mountainous here. But you're right, because if
It
I go
comes
to.
down the other side of the Jordan to
Yeah,
the Samaria.
if you want to avoid Samaria, you've got to do this, okay? Which means you've got to cross the Jordan twice, actually, and you can sneak back in there. I don't, this talks about. This is the actual journey we're going to take today as you went up through Samaria, but usually you didn't for reasons we'll pick up a bit later. But so if you're going to avoid the mountains mainly, you could sort of go that way, I guess, but you either sneaked down there down the edge of Samaria or you crossed over to get to Galilee. Okay, so in John chapter 4, the first interesting point I noticed there is it says, in verse 4, he had to go through Samaria. Had to. Well, why did he have to? Is there anything in the first three verses that tells us why he had to go through Galilee? Sorry, go through Samaria. Any reason given, do you think?
Avoiding the Pharisees.
Well, that's the reason why he set off and did a journey. So yes, that's certainly there. And it was actually because Jesus was becoming very popular and the Pharisees heard about it. So that motivated him to go back once more to Galilee. But he doesn't say why on this case he went through Samaria rather than did the extra round trip. Now, I'm not sure I totally believe this, but obviously it's longer if you go round. And if you're going all the way from, well, Judea and therefore Jerusalem area, all the way up to Galilee, it would take you about 3 days walking. And it might double that time if you have to go round and cross the Jordan. I don't quite know why it's an extra 3 days on top of 3 days. To go to the east of Jordan, but certainly would add more time onto it. So you'd prefer to go through Samaria if you could. But he doesn't say why he had to. And that word had to is literally, it was necessary to. Not just he thought he might as well, but it was necessary to. It's the same word for must do, as in John 3, you get, you must be born again. When Jesus is talking to Nicodemus. And also, it's the same as in John 3, verse 14, when it says, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. And it's again in that chapter where John the Baptist says in verse 30, he must become greater, I must become less. And it's several other times in John's gospel. It's a typical expression that's used there, meaning absolutely necessary. Now, the only other reason I can think of why Jesus had to go through Samaria in this case is because the Father told him to, because that's the way Jesus operated, obviously. It was like, where do I go today, Lord? Who do I speak to? What's going to happen? Father, tell me your will and I'll do it. So no doubt he was following the Father's instructions, and as we know from what's going to happen, although we're going to try and look at the story a bit differently, we know that there were good results, if you like. There was a really positive outcome that did something that actually is the beginning of something that's going to happen more and more and more. Now, the next question obviously is then, why do people normally avoid Samaria, or basically, who were the Samaritans at the time. So what have you actually learned from that? What do you know to answer those questions? Why did people avoid Samaria, and who exactly were the Samaritans?
Was there some feeling against them because they'd intermarried with other people in the area since they'd made that Samaria to split from the northern kingdom to split from the southern kingdom?
There's certainly something in what you're saying.
When they came back from when they were in Babylon, the Babylonians, wherever it was, shoveled everyone around and moved people from place to place. And they put the people into Samaria. And because do you remember they had to go and send for people to show them how to worship the gods of that land? So those people in Samaria weren't originally Jewish people. But as Betty's just said, they did intermarry with some Jewish people who were there.
Right. And that again sounds partly true, but I'm just bothered the moment you said the word Babylonians.
Well, when they got sent from, when they were sent out of the land to Babylon, whoever it was, I can't remember. Okay. That it was those, they sent people in. They moved everybody.
Okay, we'll pick that up and we'll have a bit more. But John or Rose, is it?
The Assyrians.
Mm. Yeah, the Assyrians. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
The Assyrians put the Jews into exile and put their own people in there. And then Lion started killing them all off. So they had to put some Jewish people back there to placate God. So the lions had stopped eating the Assyrian immigrants.
Well, thank you. I've not heard about the lions bit.
Oh, you should read your Bible.
Okay, thank you. Ooh, right. Send you away. The interesting thing is that when we think of Samaritans, you've got to remember that basically they were Israelites, okay? So what happened, as far as I'm aware, is that when the Assyrians came along after the split, so we're talking about the northern kingdom, then they took a lot of them away into exile. But as usual, when this sort of thing happens, not everybody is taken away. So maybe some were brought back, I don't know. But there were always some remnants of the Jews, even from the Babylonian exile, still hanging around. So what you ended up with in that part of the land was you had those who were just Assyrians who had come in. You had those, I'm not sure there were many, who remained as Israelites, we better call them, Northern Kingdom Israelites, and others who intermarried, which was probably most of them. So what we've got here, whenever we come across, in this case, it's going to be a woman, a Samaritan woman, it's best to think of her as a Samaritan Israelite. In other words, she was an Israelite who had married, no doubt, an Assyrian. I mean, some of them might have married still other Israelites, but there was a huge mix, is what I'm saying. But they were different from the Judean Israelites, okay? They had parted, literally, a long, long time ago. But of course, they had a common heritage because originally they were one kingdom. So the Samaritan Israelites, or so we just call them Samaritans, but bear in mind now what we're actually talking about, they called themselves firstly the sons of Israel, because that's what they were. They were the northern kingdom. They were the sons of Israel as opposed to Judah. They also called themselves the keepers, the Shomrim. And you might then ask, well, keepers of what? Well, they would answer and say, we are the keepers of the ancient faith, of the traditions. We are the faithful remnant, effectively, of the northern tribes. And they believed that the southern Israelites, the Judean Israelites, had gone wrong, which, of course, is all behind the north-south split anyway. So because they were based upon the northern kingdom, even if they stayed and became Samaritans, they still were split from the Judeans and therefore, should we say, didn't get on. Do you remember one way in which they didn't get on, or any ways in which they didn't get on with each other?
Where to worship.
Okay. Did you remember one of the maps gave a hint of that? let's try and bring it up again. I asked you if you have any of the features. Look at that again. Does that remind you of anything?
Did the Samaritans have to worship at Mount Gerizim?
Right, yeah. So we've got two mountains here, Gerizim and Ebal. Anyone remember those from anything?
Mount of Blessings and Cursings.
Blessings. Yeah.
That's somewhere towards the end of Deuteronomy, isn't it, where as they come into the land, half of the tribes are on one mountain, half on the other, and they recite the blessings and the curses. So they were quite significant mountains. I imagine you could probably see from one to the other. Samaria, that's the town of Samaria, which gave the whole region its name, I dare say. But here's the other key point, Shechem or Sychar, if that's how they pronounce it, Sychar, which is going to be in our story. Remember anything about this place, Shechem in particular, perhaps? Anything that happened there?
The Reubenites, no, the Simeonites and the Levites killed whoever it was that Abraham, I've forgotten the story, but there was a Dinah, the story of Dinah.
Oh, Jacob, okay.
Jacob's
yes. Okay.
That happened at Shechem.
Yes.
Slaughtered the people who salted the sister. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That wasn't the main thing I was thinking about, but it certainly ties in with Jacob. Again, we're going to see this in a minute in the text.
Wasn't that where the tabernacle was?
No, that was Shiloh.
That's Shiloh. That's Shiloh. Okay. But something did happen at Shechem that was significant. Joshua renewed the covenant there. That's the end of Joshua. So we renewed the covenant, and it's basically, you know, how it, the story ends in Joshua. But you're right, also, it's to do with Jacob. And this, I think, also was where Joseph's bones were brought to.
Yeah.
I think Joseph.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And while I've got this up, you might have seen that I've got another picture. That apparently is Mount Gerizim. Having said that, it doesn't look much different from any other mountain with some buildings on it in the area. So that isn't the most exciting picture I've ever shown you. But apparently that's Mount Gerizim today. All right, let's get back to John anyway, to the text, John 4. So one of the problems between them was the worship was different. So in John, we've got Jesus had to go through Samaria. He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was there. And it's the same place named as Shechem. Now, on that map, now that I've pulled it down, but you might remember that it was in the southern part of Samaria, so you didn't have to go far into Samaria before you got to that particular place. So he hasn't gone very far on his journey at this particular point. And he was tired, and it says that he sat down by the well. Anyone got a different translation for that little phrase, sat down by the well?
I've got upon it.
Upon it, yeah, exactly.
He's sitting upon the well.
Yeah, because that's what you do. There it is. Wells look like this or like this. And so that Jesus, you sit on the edge of the well. You don't sort of sit by, you don't get your deck chair out and think, oh, let's sit here for a while. Obviously, it's built up like this for several good reasons, like to stop people falling into it, or even just the dust to go into it, or small creatures to fall into it. So there was always a nice seat available. Well, it may not be nice, but there was a seat available there in order to rest on while you were resting from your journey, or while you were having your drink and so on. The other thing to say about the Samaritans, having talked about the mountain and the place of worship, what they had in common, therefore, was they both believed in the same God, Yahweh. but they had different appreciations of the scriptures. Anyone know what I'm talking about there? Anyone?
They accepted the Torah, books of Moses, but yeah. I don't think they believed in the prophets and the writings.
Exactly. So they said the only scriptures are the Torah, and therefore their prophet, their pretty well their only prophet, was Moses. That's going to be important later. So lots of things in common, but lots of things very different. And the best sort of modern example is, I suppose, trying to think of something like Sunni and Shia Muslims, where they've got a lot in common, going back to Muhammad, but they split, and now they're totally different and at odds with each other. The point is that they each believed that they had the true faith, Jewish faith, and the other was an imposter. And therefore, there's a lot of tension. There's more conflict between Judean Israelites and Samaritan Israelites than normally comes across in the Bible. But it was there within their life, generally. But we often don't notice that. We have all the stuff happening in Judea, all the stuff happening in Galilee. We know Samaria is sort of there, but there's more tension there than you usually realise for these particular reasons. They did actually still speak Hebrew, although it had changed a little bit. So there was a version called Samaritan Hebrew. They did use the ancient Hebrew script, but eventually that changed a little bit as well. And as I say, they even believed their version of the Torah was the original, whereas the Judeans had an edited version that had been changed since they'd been into exile and come back again. And of course, the Judean Samaritans said, oh, no, no. Sorry, the Judean Israelites said, no, it's the Samaritan Israelites that have got the corrupted version. So we got Jesus sitting on this well, very near to Shechem in the vicinity. And you also saw on the map, it's very near to Gerizim. So it's sort of there as a backdrop, as indeed are Joseph's bones, though that may not really feature in the story a great deal. And then along comes a Samaritan woman. Now, what, if anything, do you know about this Samaritan woman? Or what can you deduce about her?
I think she worshipped God.
Yes, okay. Because she was an Israelite in origin, therefore, yes.
Like she was alone. She was alone.
Yeah.
It was about the sixth hour. Highly unusual for.
Well, we'll think about that in a moment. I think
she had several husbands. Okay. And some of them weren't her husbands.
She was alone, wasn't she? She was alone.
Alone.
She was a working girl.
That's what she's saying. You're saying alone, right? Okay. How old was she? Any idea? I'm not saying there's a number there to tell you. I'm just saying, what do you think? How do you picture her? How do you imagine her?
Has it not been suggested that actually she was a working girl, a sex worker?
Well, it might have been, but it's certainly not in the text.
I know. But in actual fact, it has been suggested that. So therefore, she wouldn't have been that old. She wouldn't have been ancient.
True. But there's no reason to suggest that. So what I'm trying to do now is actually look at it from a Jewish perspective of a text that they would understand, rather than the way that Christians have manipulated it, usually to try and get a better gospel message out of it. And we're going to see that Jesus actually deals with her perhaps in a different way from what we might have thought. Well, I'm going to suggest that she wasn't a young person at all, particularly if she's had all these husbands. We'll come back to her husbands later. Now, you mentioned the sixth hour, which, of course, is what on our clock? Sixth hour is?
Day. What, 3 in the afternoon?
No.
No? Noon?
No. Midday.
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 Okay, it starts at 6 a.m. 6 a.m. is your first, is where it starts. So then the sixth hour is midday. And a lot is made of this, as in that's unusual because it must be really hot. What's the problem with that argument or that assumption?
only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday sun. And they go to Israel. It's hot. People stay in the shade.
Yeah, but it isn't the hottest hour. It gets hot afterwards.
Wasn't it going back to the fact that she'd had all these husbands and was thought to be a prostitute, so she would avoid the other times when respectable people were at the well?
Yes, that's what's usually said, and it's a big assumption from the text, and I want to try and disregard that, because I think it leads us in the wrong direction. To be honest, I think people have got this wrong from that point of view. There's nothing unusual about going to a well at noon. It isn't the hottest, and anyway, it might not be summer. And we don't even know that this was her usual time of going.
And it's cooler in the mountains anyway.
Yeah. Do you remember someone else that turned up at a well at noon, the sixth hour, with lots of sheep?
Yes.
And met her husband there.
Rachel.
Yeah. It was Rachel, wasn't it? Came to the well with her sheep. Now, yes, at midday, the sun is high, but it hasn't really heated up until the sun has been high for a while and started to come down again. So it isn't necessarily that hot. It isn't necessarily summer. And it isn't necessarily her usual time of going. So let's try and get rid of all the things that you've been sort of fed as though this is what it's all about. Now, yes, there was nobody else there at this particular time, I'll grant you that. And she's come from a nearby village. There's something else about that nearby village, by the way. Why is Jesus alone?
The disciples have gone to get some food.
Yeah, so they'd gone to the very village that she'd probably come from. It was the nearest one. Now, if Jews and Samaritans don't get on and not meant to mix, and here they are going through the land, suddenly Jesus says, you pop off to that village and get some food. Okay, that might be interesting. But how does the whole conversation begin? Who begins the conversation and how does it begin?
Jesus, by asking for a drink.
Yeah. Why do you think he asks her for a drink?
The conversation.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I think are two good reasons as well.
Well, he might not have had a container to be able to get the water out.
Exactly. The other reason is he was thirsty. You know, I mean, come on, always think obvious. But yeah, you're right. He got absolutely nothing to draw the water with. And so when she says, how can you ask me for a drink and so on, what's her problem at this point?
He was a Jew and she was a Samaritan.
Okay, let's be a bit clear about that. He was a Judean. Okay, which is always the word actually in John's Gospel translated as Jew. You are Judean and I am Samaritan. Okay, but why is that a problem about a drink?
Being unclean.
Well, you need to be a bit more precise than that.
They didn't use the same vessels to drink.
Exactly, yeah. It would be the problem of the container that she had got, that for herself, obviously, that if she used that and gave it to Jesus, then she couldn't use it herself. In fact, she has a water jar, to be honest, but she must have probably bought something else or means of dipping it down. So the whole business of being asked for a drink is quite a bad one for her, because she realises that this is like having to deal with him involving the water jar, the jug or whatever. But then the disciples were going to the town to buy food from Samaritans. So that's all there as well.
In mine, in my translation, you said earlier about how he must do this and he must do that. I've got, you must give me something to drink.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't got that in my translation. Which let's have a little look. It's certainly there later on in verse 20 where we must worship, and in verse 24 again must worship. I haven't got that as an example, but that's interesting. You must give me a drink. I'll have to look at the Greek to see if it's the same then.
You must give me something to drink.
Okay. Has anyone else got that or anything?
It's in the One New Mind, One New Man Bible, is that?
Okay. Well, I'd say I'd have to look up the Greek to be sure if it's exactly the same phrase. Anyway.
In the Greek, it just says, give me to drink.
Oh, I see. So it won't use the word must, but it's put in order to get across the command, the imperative of it.
Mm.
Okay. So you're right. It's sort of less polite than, will you please give me a drink? Then it's a bit more, give me one. Okay. How does she know that he was a Judean?
Well, you had said there was a difference in their language, so maybe it was an accent he had that she could pick up by his voice.
Yes, I think that probably is that, in which case you wouldn't know that until he spoke. In other words, if they were dressed similarly, which they would be, I don't think there's any real difference in the way that they dressed, she would approach the situation and not realise until he actually spoke that he was a Judean. And that's the beginning of the issue here. Oh, I see. You're a Judean. I'm a Samaritan. Well, let's first of all sort out the fact. Why are you asking me for a drink? Because you've got to use my vessel and we can't do that. Do not associate with includes that aspect of things.
Excuse me, Paul. Wouldn't Jesus have had a Galilean accent?
Okay. Right. That's a good point. Having been brought up there, yes. It still would have been different, perhaps, from the Samaritan. I mean, slightly. I'm assuming that's the best option for realising the difference by the fact that he spoke, said something. But, yeah, you're quite right. Galilean would be a better option, perhaps, than that. But you're still, well, she's still calling him Judean because that's almost the opposite of being Samaritan. Whether she thinks he's come from Judea because it's sort of on that way just outside of Judea, I don't know. But, yeah, interesting point. Thank you. So Jesus develops the conversation at that point and starts to mention living water. What's living water? What makes water alive?
It hasn't been sitting around, so rainwater.
Yes, yeah, say it again, last bit. Rainwater, did you say?
Yes, rainwater.
Yes, a bit. There's a better example, really, but you're right about it's not sitting around.
River water, moving water.
Moving water, yeah. Spring water is a good way, but yeah, rivers as well. As opposed to the well or cistern water,
which would be dead.
Which is known as, well, dead water, if you like. But every time the phrase living water comes up, it does mean water that's moving, spring water and so on. And it is typically that cistern water is religion, living water is a proper relationship with God. And Jesus, of course, said, out of you will come living water, by which he meant the Holy Spirit. So he's actually offering something which is more life-giving, because it is living water. But of course, she's still thinking about the well and so on and starts developing the conversation along those lines. But that's why towards verse 14, he talks about a spring of water, because that's the idea of the living water. Now, she gets interested in this, and that's when Jesus introduces the idea of the husbands. Now, there is no condemnation at this point. He just says, go call your husband. And she says, I have no husband. You are right when you say that. You have had five husbands. There's no indication at all, and there mustn't be any assumption that any way this was her fault, that she was somehow just sleeping around. It was sexual behavior. She had fallen into sin or whatever. She's just had five husbands, and we don't know the background to this. Somehow they had died. Now you could say, does that mean she was a bad cook? Does it mean that she's done something like that? But at this point, the reference to the fact you have had five husbands is meant to make us think that she is a victim, that she is to be pitied, not that she is bad, okay? That she's had a rough life and things haven't gone well for her. And Jesus leaves that bit at that. Now, the fact that at the moment, you're right when you say you have no husband, the man you now have is not your husband, it doesn't, again, necessarily mean that she's living with someone as though married, you know, in a sexual relationship. Women in those days didn't live alone. Maybe all the men had given up on her because they thought, I don't want to be number six in this little list. But it may be a relative. It may just be someone looking after her in some way, because Jesus never takes this up as though somehow she's adulterous, promiscuous, or whatever. And once you get that in mind, it changes everything about what you feel about her going to the well on her own or going at a different time. When she goes back to the town and starts to report what's happened, what's the response then? Or basically, what's the response to her? She goes back into the town with this message. And what's their reaction to this? For her personally? Do they shun her? Do they tell her, go away? We don't want anything to do with you.
Well, they all rush back to the well with her, I guess, to either to confirm what she said or to hear more.
Yeah, but the point is the reaction to her is favourable. In other words, they are used to mixing with her.
Yes, okay? Right. They don't shun her.
They don't shun her. That's the important thing. And she willingly goes back to them. So this assumption that's made from the beginning about why she's there and when she's there and what's her life been like and so on, which isn't actually really part of the story at all, leads us down the wrong path. She's not like the woman taking
in the adultery. Whereabouts did it say that?
Say what, sorry?
Whereabouts did it say that?
Say what?
Whereabouts did it actually say it?
No, where does it say that they don't shun her? Where does it say that they rush back to the world? But it's not at all.
We can't see it here.
We can't find it in our writings. Or is that assuming?
No, I'm reading it. I've jumped to the very end of it. Because when she goes back and she says, well, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Come back to that in a minute. They came out of the town and made their way towards him. And then many of the Samaritans believed in him. They didn't say, oh, we don't believe you, that this is nonsense and so on.
Do they actually get up and go with her?
No, I don't necessarily know about that bit, but she went to them and they didn't push her away. That's what I'm saying on this. They listened to her, they believed her, which is sort of a bit unusual in itself. But if she was a loner, an outcast, firstly, she wouldn't necessarily have gone rushing back to them because she'd have been ashamed or embarrassed or something. And well,
she was well known that they would.
She was accepted. She was, if anything, I think they were sort of sympathetic because she's had this rough life, this background of losing her husband every few years. But they might have thought, well, that's very unusual. And, you know, they might have treated her as a little bit odd from that point of view, but not because she was an outcast or somebody very sinful.
Well, that might have been tied up with the family, though. You know, the brothers having to marry the way the law was laid down.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we've always got to bear in mind, what did the Samaritans believe? Well, if that's in the Torah, which it is, then absolutely right, that might have happened. I mean, you have had, it's just left there. You've had five husbands. It doesn't say how long she had them for. What did they leave her, perhaps? But it doesn't say that she left them because, it certainly doesn't say she was a prostitute. It certainly doesn't say that she was misbehaving in any way. We're meant to read the story as though, Jesus is sympathetic towards her. Yeah. He's treating her probably. But what I'm saying is that you'll have read and heard this story more than anything else as a gospel message. And it's a better gospel message if she's an out and out sinner. And she probably therefore wasn't. And the other thing is, when she says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did, I bet you've either assumed or been told that means all the wrong I ever did. And again, it's not, he hasn't been haranguing her and saying, you've done this wrong, you've done that wrong and done that wrong. We'll come back to what he might have said in a minute, because there's always more in a conversation than gets recorded. But basically, she is able to go back and say, he's told me everything about my life. And it's almost like, and he hasn't condemned me. He hasn't told me off. Basically, we're going to see what she does say in a minute. We've got a hand up. Sorry, Caroline.
Caroline.
I missed you for a while.
No, that's fine. I was going to just say the verse that you have just said, verse 29.
Yeah.
But in my version, it says, come see a man who told me all the things that I have done.
Yeah.
She didn't say, come see a man who said everything that's happened to me.
Oh, but okay. Yes.
You're suggesting.
Yeah, sorry, did I say that wrong then?
No.
Oh, I didn't. Okay. Yeah.
I am saying that because she is saying that he told me all the things that I have done rather than
happened to me. Yeah.
Things that have happened to me.
Yes. Okay. But I'll come back to that, what that might be about in a minute. But anyway, we got the John, Jan.
Yeah, me. Just looking at how it's put in my version implies that there might have been some relevance in the fact that she was a woman.
Yeah.
I wonder, was that a problem too, that he shouldn't be talking to a woman he didn't know?
Yes. When the disciples come back, they are surprised by that fact. That's verse 27. So, yes, there is that as well. Add that into the mix if you like, by all means. Lynn?
Picking up on Caroline's verse 29, going on to verse 30, it says, Caroline says, this is not the Christ, is it? So she didn't just go along to see them and say, this man's told me everything I've ever done. She's actually saying, is this the Christ? And that was what would have interested them, the fact that she's mentioning the Christ rather than any of what he said or whether she was a prostitute or anything. It was the Christ that would have interested them.
Well, we better go back and fill in the gaps now because
My version says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could he possibly be the Messiah? So the people came streaming from the village to see him.
Yeah, that's right. And we better go back and fill in the gaps that we've left, because after the husband bit, in verse, 19? By the way, have you noticed how polite she is? How does she always address Jesus? She's done it twice in verse 11 and then verse 19.
Sir?
Yes, just that's a extra thought there. So the first thing is that she's interested in is that I can see you are a prophet, okay? So she's recognised from the conversation they've had so far that he is in some way a prophet. And then she starts debating with him about worship. And again, it's very commonly put as, she's trying to avoid the issue. She doesn't want to hear any more about husbands and so on, as though she's sort of diverting into some other kind of religious argument. But in fact, this was, as I said, such a key point that they would always want to discuss this debate, this business about worship, quite like normal and natural, to talk about this. And she actually effectively is saying, we do this, you do that, and implied, well, we're right on this, aren't we, sort of thing. And Jesus's answer is actually quite startling, because although he eventually says to her, you Samaritans worship what you do not know, which is a bit of a sort of tough thing to say, he basically doesn't argue back and say, no, you're wrong, we're right, as in, it's definitely this mountain. And don't forget, Mount Gerizim was there. So when she says our fathers worshipped on this mountain, she might even be pointing at it and say this one, you know, one you can see. We worshipped on this mountain. You claim it's in Jerusalem. Let's have a discussion about that if you like. And Jesus startles her by saying, it's not that mountain, it is Jerusalem. Jesus offers a third alternative. He offers a sort of new way of this by saying, in the end, it's not going to matter which mountain at all. Now, she would not have expected that. She would have expected the standard Judean reply, if you like. And although your English version will say our fathers worshipped on this mountain, because that's actually how we speak, we talk about being on a mountain. In Hebrew talk, and that they use the phrase in the mountain. So you're on it, but they use the phrase in. So when Jesus says you will worship the Father neither on this mountain, he's actually saying in. So following this through, the time is coming when you'll worship the Father neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem, but in something else. And that's where you get the phrase in spirit and in truth. In other words, it's all about in, never about on as such, but not in this mountain, not in this mountain, not in this city, but in, and it becomes non-geographical completely. Now that is new, that's staggeringly new at that point. And that changes her thinking from, I see you're a prophet, to I see you are, well, she starts to say, I wonder if, because I know that Messiah, John in brackets adding Christ, just in case we haven't worked that out tonight, but she will use the word Messiah, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. So what Jesus has said has now taken her thinking away from just being, he's a prophet because he knows what I've been through, he knows what my life has been like and all the things I've done, to he's now teaching me something radical and new. And he's already talked about living water, and now he's talking about worshipping in something, not in a place, in a mountain, but in a totally different way. And you notice also he's added in verse 22 a phrase which you're familiar with, but I wonder if you knew it was here, for salvation is from the Judeans. Okay, not Jews, Judeans. For salvation is from the Judeans, a phrase that we use quite a bit, using the word Jews, of course, but actually it's in this context that he starts to announce this. Now, big question coming up. When she says, I know that Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he'll explain everything to us, how does she know that? How does she know about Messiah at all?
She'll tell her all things.
But how does she know that?
Wouldn't it be from the prophets?
Ah, but what did we say earlier?
From Psalms.
She didn't believe in the prophets, did she?
They don't have the prophets.
Right.
You can't point to Isaiah 50 something or whatever.
But Moses did say that someone would come. Yeah. And I forget where it is.
I'll tell you in a minute, but yeah, you're right now. Yeah. So she doesn't have... I thought someone was saying something then. She doesn't have all the prophets or even the writings to help on this. It's got to come from the first five books. And if you think about it, everything that Jesus has done and said, he's got to link it in to those first five books. So where is there any mention of anybody like this in the first five books? So one hint was in Deuteronomy that we just had, because Moses she would know about. So it's in Deuteronomy 18. Okay, Deuteronomy 18. I want to find this, where is it Moses or God is saying, God says this to Moses, first of all, and then Moses passes it on. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. And then it goes on, I'll raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and so on. So she is expecting someone to come who will be a prophet. But she won't have got the idea of Messiah from anything, unless possibly, possibly, in Genesis 49. Now, in Genesis 49, you've got Jacob blessing his sons. Jacob blessing his sons. And when he comes to Judah, you might be familiar with these verses, particularly verse 10. But what Jacob says about Judah is actually quite prophetic and quite revealing. So if you look at Genesis 49 and go from, say, verse 8 to verse 10, what do you think that, well, a Samaritan woman, if you like, would get out of that? Or what would they be able to draw specifically from that? Do you spot a messianic verse? Oh, sorry, Lynn, have you got your hand up for this?
Yes, but I'd actually had my hand up before because I was going to say it's not just this woman, the Samaritan woman, all the Jewish people, be they Judeans or whatever they were all waiting for the prophet to come like Moses.
Yeah.
That's how they're waiting for the prophet. Jesus, by all his miracles, is demonstrating that he's the prophet like Moses, isn't he?
Yes, and of course they asked John the Baptist whether he was the prophet, as well as being the Christ. They didn't expect the Christ and the prophet were the same, though, but yes, they were also expecting that.
It's until Shiloh comes.
Yeah, go on.
It's in verse 10.
Okay.
It's a break.
Keep going.
The word Shiloh is a composite of the words and lo, a gift to him, a reference to the King Messiah.
Okay, we need to understand this because not everybody will have got the word Shiloh.
No, that's right. It's, sorry? And no, not everybody will have a Shiloh, won't they, right?
Not in their translation, no.
No.
You might have got a footnote about it because it is a complicated verse. The bit you're reading is until he comes to whom it belongs.
Yes.
Okay. But it starts off about the scepter will not depart from Judah.
That's right.
Between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. So in this prophetic statement from Jacob about Judah, notice Judah, interestingly enough, got to come to terms with that, the Samaritans do. This obviously is a future king. It's clear from the earlier part of the verses 8 and 9 that, again, Judah is going to be raised up to some ways, be like the brothers will praise you, your hand will be on the neck of your enemies and so on. Or at least not Judah himself personally, but out of Judah, out of the tribe. But it will all this will remain within Judah until the right person comes to whom it belongs. Now, because we've got, shall we say, better, more specific messianic prophecies and promises to come. This for us isn't quite such a big one. But if it's all you've got, then that's what you're going to rely on, really.
Mm.
But so she hasn't got a lot of information, a lot of clues on all this, but she does seem to know that someone that you call Messiah will come and he will explain everything to us. The limit of her knowledge is that he will be more a prophet than anybody else. And that's why Jesus has been speaking prophetically to her. And it's always worth contrasting Jesus' methods. And again, you might have heard this, that if you read John 3 and see how Jesus deals with Nicodemus, it's totally different from John chapter 4, the next chapter, a few days, whatever, when he's dealing with someone for whom he would never talk in that sort of way, but he has to relate to what she has in her knowledge and background. Mary, you want to say something?
I'm just noticing that in verse 10 of Genesis 49, my version says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes.
Yeah.
And now I've got a wee note beside Shiloh and it says tranquil.
Oh, okay. Trying to explain what the word means. Yeah. Okay.
And yeah. That'll be the obedience of the people. Just with the other lady had something completely different in her Bible.
Yeah. Well, that's because it's a complicated verse, I think, obviously within the Hebrew language, but also because it's sort of some prophetic thing, Jacob talking about one of his sons, Judah, it's probably meant to be a bit sort of mysterious. We won't really know until he comes to whom it belongs. Now, we know who that is now. But despite all that, let's just get hold of the fact that here's a woman with a certain limited background, knowledge, scriptures, and so on, that she's met Jesus. She recognizes in him someone who can speak prophetically and say everything I ever did. And the point is, I mean, mentioned that before, we don't know exactly what he said to her because we always get just an abbreviated version of a conversation. I mean, Jesus declares, I who speak to you am he. And that's the end, as far as we know. Of course, the next thing that happens is the disciples return. And I would love to know what the woman said in reply to Jesus's statement, I who speak to you am he. But it's like suddenly dashing onto the stage comes all the disciples back. Oh, you're talking to a woman. What are you doing that for? Why are you talking with her? And so on. And the next thing we know, she's left. So how annoying that they've come along at the wrong time and interrupted this fascinating conversation. But maybe there's been more said earlier, because when she does go back to the town, she seems to be able to say, he told me everything I ever did. Or maybe it's just an impression that here is someone so special, so prophetic, and I wonder if he is the one that in a shadowy sort of way we believe is going to come, because he seems to be able to see right into me. But she doesn't go back, as I've said, and say, he's come and convinced me that I'm a real sinner and that I've got to change my ways and all the rest of it. Her only statement is, could this be the Messiah? You know, not even my Saviour, not even anybody that's going to, you know, not like John saying, behold the Lamb of God, and so on. Just the Messiah.
Yes. Can you go back to verse 26? Because she says, Yeshua said to her, I am the one who is speaking to you.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that would have been a statement okay. to her as well, if he used
the I am.
I am.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting in our version, again, it's I who speak to you am he, rather than yeah. I am. But it amounts to the same thing, and maybe there's something in that. Yeah. But again, it's not that she's suddenly saying, oh, yes, you're God or the Son of God. All she's interested in at this point is that he is prophetic and maybe he is the one to come that they're calling Messiah. And don't forget, there's many different ideas of what Messiah was going to be like, even amongst the Judeans. So, you know, it opened up another sort of debate on that. John, Rose?
Yeah, I would support the I am kind of process. Yeah. I am the one speaking to you with emphasis rather than, oh, it's just me, you know.
Yeah, okay.
There are so many occurrences, particularly in the Gospel of John, where Jesus says, I am. And it has often been translated rather weakly, I'd like to say, and not as strong as perhaps it should be.
Yeah, I take the point, and I think that's right, that that our English version may well have just toned it down a little bit. I mean, I think it's still being fairly forceful, I who speak to you am he, but you're right, if it was put the other way around, it'd be even more, probably mean more to her. Jackie? You're muted still, Jackie.
Sorry, in my Greek version, it is the other way around. Yeah. Jesus said to her, I am, ego, I me.
Yeah, okay.
The one speaking to you.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I think that's right. So, again, I still would love to know what her response is to that before the disciples come barging in again. But if that's meant to be the end point of the conversation, in other words, everything that's needed to be said has actually been said, even if we don't have every word of the conversation. It was enough to, you notice that, well, she didn't get any water and Jesus never got his drink. So he's still thirsty at that point. But she leaves her water jar. I mean, why does she leave a water jar? Because it's quicker to go back without it, perhaps. She's suddenly in a hurry. Suddenly it doesn't matter. She wants to get back to them. And yeah, as someone pointed out earlier, it doesn't actually say that she came back with them, but they came out of the town and so on. And then the disciples get a bit of a lesson because they're surprised and think this perhaps shouldn't have happened. And Jesus has to teach them a lesson. Might come back to that in a minute. But what's the ultimate outcome of this whole thing? Remember we said, why did he have to go through Samaria? We don't know. We don't know necessarily why it was necessary for that journey or for that particular time. But the answer is it was necessary because of the result, which was what? we've got Jackie and then Maureen. But also, you want to say something, Jackie? Is your hand still up? No. Okay. Why did he have to go through Samaria then to be think at the end, whole story? Maureen?
May I just say that when he says, I am he, I who am up talking to you.
Yeah.
That was the last thing he said to her.
Yeah.
So that would have made an impression.
Yes, indeed.
That would be the words in her head.
Yeah, as I said, I would like to have more conversation, but perhaps it was best it did end there. You know, the big finish and then her response from there. So, yeah, okay. Mary's hand is up. You might see on screen, Mary. You've disappeared off the screen. There we are. You are there.
And I don't want to take this. It says here he stayed there for 2 days.
Yes.
So they had a lot of training to do there, and I think Jesus would know that this was to happen.
Exactly. Certainly by then, he would suddenly realise why. That is extraordinary. Okay, if you're not even meant to mix with them, if you're not meant to even go through, or you prefer not to, it wasn't a rule you couldn't, but the best thing was to avoid them. Why then does he suddenly stay? Well, that has to be because it was the Father's will. Karen?
It's in verse 39, isn't it? But also, I'm thinking back to when he sent the disciples out.
Yeah, we're coming to that.
To them, Beg your pardon. Okay,
yeah.
I'll shut it up then.
No, it's all right. I just wanted to know that I hadn't forgotten that. But we come to the end of this particular story, this particular passage then. Whatever reason he had for going to Galilee, he obviously wasn't in a great hurry, or at least he was prepared to have his plans changed. And it essentially says in verse 43, after the 2 days, he left for Galilee. So he gets on back to his journey. But he is prepared to stay where there because of the response. And many of the Samaritans believed in him because of the woman's testimony. And I come back again to the point that if she was of ill repute or whatever, they wouldn't even be listening to her. If she was an outcast, they wouldn't be that interested. Somehow she was able to get back to them and say what needed to be said and so on. Okay, unless there's any other comments on this chapter, there's two other things to think about as far as Samaria is concerned, one of whom we just had a hint about. But the other Samaritan you know about isn't a woman, but is a man. What other Samaritan do we know about?
The Good Samaritan?
Yeah, the so-called Good Samaritan, because is he called good in the text, which is Luke chapter 10? He's only called good in the heading that someone has decided to put there and call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. He is not called good in the text itself, from what I can see. Lynn?
Sorry, I'm actually popping back to your Samaritan woman. Okay. You've been asking why she's got why he had to go through Samaria. Yep. Well, if you look back into chapter 3, where they were doing the baptizing in John 3, verse 22, 23, it says that John was baptized in Ainon near Salim, and that's where, and that isn't, that is at the bottom of Samaria, is not by the Jordan where the baptizing was. So it's in the middle of that mountain range. I'm just looking at a map, and it's, where is it? It's not, it's by that river. Oh, well, you can't see my me pointing to you. But yes, it's near the middle. Where, well, I can't see what that little green town is.
I'm getting
it's somewhere
there.
Near there.
Well, oh, okay. Well, I'm so trying to show.
Yeah, that's where they've got it.
Yeah.
Where he was baptizing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they've got it there.
No, I have on that one.
A-E-N-O-N. So that's where he was baptizing.
And it's here again.
Yeah. So they would. That's why he would have been in Samaria, not down.
Yeah.
Not on the other side of the Jordan. That's why they would have been in Samaria. And going
to this is not it.
I was going to say it's not in Samaria.
No, it's not in Samaria.
No.
No. So
I mean, and the map I'm looking at here has it more, shows it more. In but anyway, I was just looking at where they were.
Yeah. Okay.
At the starting point of their journey.
Yeah, it's a little unknown as to exactly where it was. I mean, the only thing it does say was because there's plenty of water there, doesn't it? That's why it had to be in that particular part of the river.
I've just been looking it up, and it says it's not part of the river. It says it's a spring of water, so it's a pool of water, not part of the river.
It's living water, in other words, yeah.
Yeah, yes, well, good point.
John and Rose?
Yeah, it's got a question mark there, and the suggestion is that John the Immerser was actually more likely to be between Jericho and the Jordan at that area, which is also where the Israelites came into the land in the first place.
Yeah.
So yes. I myself feel that it's more likely that the baptismal process, an immersion process, happened there.
Yeah.
And certainly it's reopened again, and that's what people are thinking for the tourists.
One question comes to mind is, was he always in exactly the same place, or might he have moved around? And it is, as you rightly say, a question mark. No one quite knows where that place is. So it's actually called Sardom, interestingly enough. And it might be the same, but it might not. So yes, it may well have been somewhere else. We've got Caroline. You're muted.
Yeah, I'm confused now because of where these places are, because if he was going from that place where we just talked about and he was going to Galilee.
No,
yeah.
Because that's further south.
I don't think that's what was being said or implied, to be honest.
I don't think those two things are necessarily related, are they?
No, it was the fact that there's a reference to baptism. That's all it was. Yes. Yes. Mm. Okay.
Yes, it can't be the same as in John 3 because the geography doesn't add up.
No, you're right from that point of view. Yeah. Okay. We've got two more people. I was trying to move on, but who else have we got? Mary again? Yeah. Mary? Okay. Perhaps Mary doesn't try to say something. Anyway,
Mary's muted.
Sorry, that's it.
My point is, it doesn't actually matter where the location is. The point is that he's healing. He's also a healer, and he's healing a breach between these different people. And that's part of his teaching. That's the way. Yeah.
Okay, right. So let's get back to Luke 10, because there's another Samaritan here. And I'm not making a big point about something that's very familiar. But the story starts in verse 30, a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. So I'm sure, again, if you look at the map, you'll understand where that journey is, where Jericho is, and that going down is a sensible way of putting it, because Jerusalem is high up and Jericho is down near the Dead Sea. So it's literally is going down. And then you get this incident that happens, and someone comes by, and then comes the big shock. a Samaritan. Now, what's the real big shock about that?
It's moved with compassion.
Now, before you get to that, why is the Samaritan? Why is the
Samaritan helping a Jew?
Yeah, but even before you get to that,
why was he there?
Why was a Samaritan making a journey from Jerusalem down to Jericho? Now, it doesn't mean that they weren't allowed to or couldn't possibly, but by introducing that into a story, people are suddenly going, oh, a Samaritan down there. That's unusual in the first place. Okay.
It describes him as a travelling Samaritan. So he's obviously a tradesman of some.
Well, again, yes, but they're not meant to mix, are they? And they're not meant to, you know, have association.
No, true.
But the point is, don't forget, this is just a story. It makes the point of it. And it makes the point because the Samaritan has been chosen. But it's in that location that adds to the tension of the story, if you like. Now, this man that was originally going down there, when you think what actually happens to him, they strip him of his clothes, beat him and went away. Where do they leave him? Where do they leave him?
In the road.
Well, the point is, does it say that?
No.
No, it doesn't. I mean, again, always we get these pictures in our mind or we hear it said like this, that he was there in the middle of the road or just on the roadside. We don't know where he was actually left. And what state was he in?
Half dead.
And what does half dead?
In verse 31, that as the priest passed by that road, he saw him.
Yeah, but he might have seen him in the distance. We don't know. I mean, I'm not saying he was a long way away. I'm just saying he wasn't there for, you weren't going to trip over him necessarily.
We're a bit lost here. Which reference? What's the reference, please?
I'm reading from Luke 10, verse 30 onwards, the parable of the Good Samaritan. We're heading towards the main point in all this. Firstly, that it's unusual that Samaritan would be there. This guy was, someone just said, okay, he's half dead. What does half dead look like?
Well, you look like in the morning, I expect, before
we wake up. That's kind of, I don't know how you know that, but you might be right. Actually, I'm going to suggest it's more than that. Someone who's half dead looks like he's dead. It couldn't look like anything else. Obviously, he's not dead. He is alive. But you can't sort of be half dead, half alive. He wasn't staggering around or something like that. He would have been lying on the road, to all intents and purposes, dead, but there was still some life in him. So the priest comes down and sees him. Maybe he's fairly nearby, but not real nearby, and then passed by on the other side. So what would the priest think when he saw that? What would he think?
You can't touch a dead body.
You don't touch a dead body. The Levite, the same. Now, then the Samaritan comes along and he basically doesn't seem to mind. He doesn't seem to mind about that. He might be dead, but it's not going to put him off. And that's a key part of the story, really, that it says when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him. So he went over to him, if you like, wherever he happens to be, whether it is on the roadside or a little bit further away, and then begins the whole process of looking after him. But the distinction here is that because the guy, he wasn't just sitting on the roadside with his head in his hands going, ooh, I'm hurt, sort of thing. He was lying around as though he'd actually been killed. And so the other two ignore him because they can't touch a dead body. The Samaritan, obviously, now that law is in the Torah, isn't it, about the dead bodies and so on. But the point I'm sure Jesus is making, one of the main points out of this, is that in this instance, the Samaritan is prepared to put that to one side. At least he goes and checks, because he might not be dead after all. And that's when he then decides that he can help him. So it's about making an assumption that I can't help because he must be dead, and therefore it would make me unclean. But it's the impact of the Samaritan bit of the story which is meant to bring the whole thing to people like that. Lynn?
This says,
can I just ask?
Despise Samaritan came along.
Oh, does it?
And he saw the man of compassion for him, yeah.
I haven't got anything that suggests that word is really sort of in the text as anybody else has, but it would just say is a Samaritan, I think. Lynn?
You're taking it that this is a true story and not just a story that Jesus is inventing to illustrate his point.
I'm not taking it as any more true.
Are we saying it was an actual incident or Jesus is just in...
No. It's certainly the case that people did get beaten up on the way from Jerusalem to Jericho. It was a known place where there was ambushes. It was to that. But no, it is a story. I'm not saying that there ever was a Samaritan, but if you're listening to it, like in all the parables and that, you're listening to it with a view of it's going to make an impact upon you because of the shocking bits of it. And in this case, it's what's a Samaritan doing here? Why is a Samaritan in this story? And why does he go and touch what he thinks might be a dead body? But no, they understood it was a story. And the last bit about Samaritans is in Acts. So the bit that Karen, I think, was eager to get to is that Jesus tells his disciples what they're going to do. So in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So Samaria gets a special mention, separate mention. Not Judea and Galilee, or Judea and just across the Jordan, you know, to other areas like that. It's all Judea and Samaria. And again, this is because Samaria wasn't, if you like, a sort of halfway point between Judea and the rest of the earth, or the ends of the earth, the rest of it. Samaria was still basically got Israelites in it. So it's like at this point, Jesus is bringing the two together in the gospel. Okay, you'll be my witnesses, firstly in Jerusalem, and then in not Judea, and then Samaria, and then the ends of the earth, but in Judea and Samaria. There is a prophecy, if you can think about where it is, where it talks about the uniting of, it's called Judah and Ephraim, Ephraim being the northern kingdom, under the king to come. Remember who gave that prophecy? One of the main prophets.
I don't know. Ezekiel.
It's Ezekiel, yes. You know the chapter?
Okay.
It's a chapter that everybody knows.
The two sticks, they're bringing the two sticks together.
Yeah. Do you know which chapter it is?
Is it 37?
Yeah. No, you first time is right, 37.
37.
The one that everybody thinks or knows is about the dry bones.
Yeah.
But that's only the first half of the chapter. Nobody bothers to read the second half.
The second half's about the two sticks coming together.
It is. In other words, it is predicted that again, eventually, under one king, and until they've got one king, it isn't going to work. But now Jesus is here, under the gospel, under his kingship, Judea and Samaria, or if you like, the disparate bits of the Israelites, can start to come back together. So it's not like Judea and then it's some kind of Gentile area and then it's the rest of the Gentiles. It's still about Judea and Samaria as Israelite base. And of course, eventually, who goes to Samaria and completes the task? Which apostle?
Philip.
Philip.
Yeah, in Acts chapter 8. Okay. So Stephen has just been stoned, Saul is there, and then a great persecution breaks out against the church at Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria, again connected together. So they're all scattered out together, and it's Philip in particular that goes down to a city in Samaria and proclaims the Christ. But there's already converts there, isn't there? Because of this woman's testimony and because of what Jesus has done. So they may still be keeping themselves to themselves a little bit, but at least many have already begun to believe on Jesus because of what happened there. And so it's like when Philip goes there and proclaims who the Christ really is and the miraculous signs and things like that, it really can take off a lot more. So just like Jesus had preached around the cities of Galilee and the parts of Judea and so on, and sort of all ready for when the apostles go around there after Pentecost, equally Samaria has been sort of pre-evangelized, if you like, that's a bit more than that, ready for Philip to go down there and complete that part of the mission. Karen and then Rose.
The part I was thinking about when I said when the disciples were sent out, he said, didn't he, that, you know, if you're not welcome, shake the dust from your shoes and carry on. But if you are welcome, stay.
Yes.
And basically do as he was demonstrating to do when he was with that woman and that village.
Yeah, but he only sent them into the towns of Galilee.
Yes, yeah. I know, but he was only, but I know that, but I'm not talking about geography.
Okay.
I'm talking about the actual act of he got a good reception, so he stayed.
Yeah. Oh, I got you. Yeah, okay, that's the comparison. Oh, I jumped in very quickly on you there, didn't I? Sorry. I thought you were going to give the game away on the actually, but thanks for coming back with a good point. Yeah. Rose, then.
I've always taken that verse about Judea and Samaria to mean we need to be ready to go where we don't want to go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the disciples that went with Jesus through Samaria and eventually got the food from the town, presumably one of them would have been Philip. We don't always get a list of names for these things, but maybe Philip was already there. But they didn't go until chapter 8. It's not like, all right, here we go, chapter 2, chapter 3, suddenly we're in Samaria. They didn't go until the church was scattered after the stoning of Stephen. And I often say about the book of Acts, it's always difficult to know exactly how much time passes between the chapters and between the different events. It sort of reads as though it's all happened within a couple of weeks, but sometimes there's years and years apart in some of these. So I leave that to others to work out exactly which year that might be. Anyway, there we are. Caroline.
Yes, now I was just looking and thinking it was interesting because in Matthew 10, you know, they were told not to go to Samaria, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And stay only, well, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But, yeah. Right, so there we are. We've been to Samaria. So next week, someone else and somewhere else. And did I say last time what it was going to be? Did I mention last time if you were there the weekend?
Yes, you did.
Oh, then I better mention it to everyone for fairness, should I? Okay. Well, our main character is going to be Rahab, and therefore we're going to Jericho and see what actually happened to her. But I also offered to any of you good folk out there, if you want to say something about a minor character for 5-10 minutes that you've read about or thought about, not the main character, don't start telling us everything about Abraham or you know, Mary Magdalene or something, but one of the what we call the lesser known characters, even unnamed, like Samaritan woman, and you think it's something interesting for 5-10 minutes, then I'm sure we've got time to do that. But anyway, Rahab next week. Is the hand still up or is it left up, Rose? John, are you going to say something?
No, it was still up.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Anyway.
Good.
Now I've forgotten. Sorry.
Well, we're not going yet, but we'll switch the recording off, okay? Shall we?